So tonight I'm going to give a talk I called The Three Layers of Delusion, or What the Heck is Happening, which we all experience at some point or another when we're practicing. We have this what? These what moments, and in our life in general, of course, too. But and basically, I want to start. This is a line from the Satipatthana Sutta, where he's talking about mindfulness of mental factors. Here he knows a lustful mind to be lustful, and a mind without lust to be without lust. He knows an angry mind to be angry, and a mind without anger to be without anger. He knows a deluded mind to be deluded, and a mind without delusion to be without delusion. A teacher summed this up in a really wonderful line I came across. His name is Buddhadasa. He says, basically, what our mind is doing is we're either pulling in, pushing away, or running around in circles, which pretty much describes the third of those. The thing about these three poisons, which is what they're often called, you know, and here we have lust, anger, delusion. Sometimes it's, you know, greed, aversion, delusion. You see different translations of those words. But the problem is desire or lust or greed or grasping and aversion or anger, these are relatively easy to notice. You know, they have pretty strong emotional content that's often quite obvious. So when we're practicing, and in life for that matter, because they have such strong effect on our body often, and on our emotions, they're easy to notice. But delusion, you know, running around in circles, our mind, the problem is that we're often so deluded we can't see that we're deluded, which is a pretty big problem, right? And so that's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about, tonight I want to talk about how we can recognize when delusion has risen. As the Buddha says, he knows a deluded mind to be deluded. So how do we know we have a deluded mind? That's the theme of this whole talk, really. I want to quote, this is a quote from the Dhammapada. This is verse 251. For those of you who don't know the Dhammapada, it's a sort of a collection of poetic teachings or pithy teachings of the Buddha. And this verse. There is no fire like passion, no seizure like anger, no river like craving, no snare like delusion. These are pretty good images. You know, it's easy to notice when we're on fire, right? Or when we're having a seizure, or we're caught in a river of craving. But when we're in a snare, and sometimes some translations this is called the net, you know, like we're caught in a net. It's like, how did I get here? And how do I get out? And oh wait, I'm in here. I didn't even notice I was in here for a while. You know, it's a very different experience than the other ones. I love going to dictionaries too. This is an actual dictionary definition from Merriam-Webster. So this delusion is a fixed false belief. A fixed false belief that is resistant to reason or confrontation with actual fact. Isn't that a great definition? Right? It's resistant to reason or confrontation with actual fact. So if that's the situation, if our mind is resistant to even accepting the fact that we're deluded, This is where a lot of work has to be done in this practice and in life in general, of course. So another way to look at this is how do we know that what we're believing in, because the delusion is based on some belief that how we're acting or how we're thinking, how we've got things figured out is okay, is right. How do we notice that? This is from the Kalama Sutta. In the Kalama, the Kalamas is a village the Buddha came to, and the residents were saying, you know, all these different holy men come, and one guy tells us one thing, and this other person tells us another thing, and we never know whether what to believe and what not to believe. How can we tell what's true? How can we tell when we're not just being led into deeper into delusion, essentially? And this is what the Buddha said here. Come, Kalamas, do not go upon what has been acquired by repeated hearing, nor upon tradition, nor upon rumor, nor upon what is in a scripture, nor upon surmise, nor upon an axiom, nor upon specious reasoning, nor upon a bias towards a notion that one has pondered over, nor upon another's seeming ability, nor upon the consideration, this monk is our teacher. Don't even believe the teacher, right? This is very important. Kalamas, when you know yourselves, these things are good, these things are not blamable, these things are praised by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to benefit and happiness, then enter and abide in them. So you'll know you're not deluded if these things are not blamable, they are praised by the wise, you've undertaken them and observed what's going on, and they lead to benefit and happiness. So that's a pretty good rule of thumb, right? But the problem is there's so many different forms of delusion. Delusion takes so many different disguises, I suppose you could say. And so I want to look at the three main classes of delusion. What I call personal delusion, cultural delusion, and human delusion. So it's a pretty broad list, right? So personal delusion, this is like unique to you in a particular situation often. You feel like you're caught in a fog. Like, what's going on? And when you come out of that deluded state, you often end up asking yourself a question along the lines of, what was I thinking? I mean, how could I have thought that? You know, what was I thinking? It's often our reaction when we come out of this deluded state, out of these personal delusions. And I made up an example here. And this is a good example of how this happens. You're on a bus going to work, or going someplace, or on a train, or you're driving along and you notice an ad on the side of the road, for that matter, that advertises a great, incredible vacation in Cabo. Let's go, you know, to the beach, and it's sunny, and you can go watch the whales, and oh, this is so great. And you go, wow, wouldn't that be great to go to Cabo and have a vacation? So you start making all these plans in your mind, you know, and you have a firm belief to begin with that your partner will love this vacation too. This is like, she's just gonna just think this is the greatest thing ever, you know, because you're gonna surprise them, right? So you check into hotels and you check into good rates for, you know, flights, and you do all that stuff, and you even go and get some brochures and, you know, different things, activities and things you can do. And then you go home and you tell your partner, "Sweetie, we've got this great vacation. We're going to go on a great vacation in Cabo," and then blah, blah, blah. And tell them all, show them all the brochures. And about halfway through, you notice the look on your partner's face. And your partner says something like, "Oh, Cabo. Yeah, I went there a couple of years ago. It was horrible. I don't want to go to Cabo." And it's like your delusion, the balloon in your mind of delusion just got popped. Poof. Just like that. Just like that. But that's what happens all the time. That's just we get into this mental space where we believe, we convince ourselves that things are going to be a certain way. And when they don't turn out that way, if we're not careful, we really suffer. Because we've been all excited and our partner isn't excited, and now we blame our partner and we get into a fight, and what, how come you never want to have any fun, and blah, blah, all that stuff we go through. Or even on the mental level, there's this thing on retreats where it's called if you're on a long retreat and there's like a mixed group of people, and you decide that some person on that retreat is like really something, and you start to imagine this whole relationship with this person. It's called a Vipassana romance. That's what the actual official term is, right? And you go through this whole thing, and it's like, this is, oh, after the retreat, we'll go someplace and we'll really get to know each other. And then, pretty soon you're married and you've got two kids in the house, and the whole story. You've got this huge, enormous story in your mind. Oh, it's all in your mind, of course. And then you notice you're standing in line, and the other person's standing in line waiting for a meal. And you see them do something like, they scratch their butt or they pick their nose. They do something really, what you think is really gross. And it's like, ooh, how could I have a relationship with? And so now you have a Vipassana divorce. This is all going on in your mind. Nothing real at all. But it's in the process, you've spent enormous amounts of energy and thought emotional suffering. Now you're suffering. Oh, I had this whole thing planned and now it's not going to work. And oh my God. All totally based on a deluded thought. Totally based in personal delusion. You thought things were going to be a certain way and then they're not. How often does this happen in our lives, in our daily lives? In our relationships with other people, or even like things that we think, I'm going to do X, I'm going to study a lot more. And then, it comes, there, and I think I'll, play some Word for Friends instead or something, and this way the mind drifts a little bit. And then you have this delusion that you're going to be like this serious, perfect, serious student. And it turns out that maybe you're not quite so serious, and that's okay. And then you have to deal with that. But anyhow, so that's personal delusion. We're all familiar with this fairly thing. The next layer, and the thing about personal delusion is it's pretty easy to see. We often catch ourselves and we go, sometimes at the end, like I said, like that we have that, what could I possibly have been thinking moment. But it's pretty easy to see. The next layer, however, is what we'll call cultural delusion. These are things we think about, or we act upon, or we decide things are a certain way, and we have some mental statement along the lines of, well, of course it's like this, or well, it's always been this way, or everybody knows this, right? These are views that are so deeply embedded that we don't even notice them. Much of what is happening right now in the world, when you look at what's going on in the world right now, how much of that how much of all the crazy things that are happening in politically, for instance, in Washington, is based totally on deluded thought, totally on people believing, as a, what was that definition? Resistant to reason or confrontation with actual fact. How much of what's going on is based on that sort of thinking? And it's like the danger here is we start to think, oh, those people are really bad. And we start to judge these people. These people are just really deeply, deeply deluded. And we have to understand that so that we don't get caught in judging them. Because in judging them, now we're deluded into thinking we're better than them. Now we've just entered into a new layer of delusion, right? Of cultural delusion. We're those pure Buddhist people who don't get caught up in this nonsense. And, those other people, those extreme right-wing Christians, oh, they're terrible. Well, that's where we go. This is cultural delusion. This is just creating separation automatically. We're judging these people. We're putting them in a box labeled other. And this goes on all the time. And this is partly how we were brought up, partly where we went to school, how we went to school, how long we went to school, who we hang out with, what the culture of our country is, our nationality, our race, our sexuality. These are all things that create cultural delusion, because they come with, by definition, I'm this. And as soon as I'm this, I'm not that. However you're slicing and dicing it. And along with that comes a whole set of stories and beliefs around being this or not being that. I want to tell you a personal example of this. This is, I'm going back to the late 60s here. So this is, I'm still in college. And I'm taking a course in sociology. And part of this course in sociology had this whole teaching about homosexual men being a product of a domineering mother and an absent or inattentive father. This was like true. This was in the textbook, right? This is what the professor was saying. So of course, innocent 19-year-old Barry just takes it in. And it, of course, the thing about these sorts of views is they sort of at some level reinforce something we already know. Like, I grew up, in a culture, in a working class, blue collar culture where homosexuality was pretty weird, basically. And of course, that's what I believed, because that's what my culture taught me. My family was a very sort of great, loving family. My father was very open and always invited people and had no prejudices about race or any of those sorts of things, but he had a very strong prejudice against gay people. And so I absorbed that from my father. And that's just like that's how things happen, right? And this sort of fed into my idea, well, these weird men are kind of psychologically damaged. That was also part of this whole teaching. And this is just like what the culture, and this is like, educated people, this is what we believe. This is a part of our education. Of course, this is all total nonsense, right? I mean, this is absolute nonsense. It's not true at all. But it was something I really believed in. And it affected how I reacted with other people I met. It wasn't until sort of after university, I was, you know, a hippie, and I sort of went out into the world a lot more and interacted with a lot of other people. And I started to meet gay people, both male and men and women, and sort of like come to the realization that really there's no difference here. I mean, there's difference in how, you know, how they love other people. Other than that, they're no different than me. I was in my mid-20s before that really sunk in, where this delusion, the balloon of this nonsense got pricked in my brain, and I realized how I'd been taken in by this delusion. But, and here's the insidious part. Even today, you know, because this is where my mind was when I was young, I have to be very conscious not to fall into those stereotypes, not to go there. And that's just something I have to always be aware of. And that's what this practice allows us to do. That's why, you know, the mindfulness practice, because you can see if you're mindful as you're interacting with someone, and you can go, oh, there's that old story from back there when I was 20. Still there, because it was so deeply embedded. And it's like I can think, oh well, that's all, I'm over that. I don't know if we're ever over some of these things that are that deep in our cultural and background in our life growing up stuff. So we have to just be very conscious, and mindfulness is very, very useful to help us deal with these sorts of things, whether they are about, as this one was about sexuality, it could be about race, it could be about politics, it could be about, you know, people with weird accents. Some of those people from the South, they talk so funny, you know. Who knows what it is that sets off these things in our minds, right? And part of this cultural delusion is that in our culture as a whole, we sort of have this belief that what we perceive, our perceptions, are correct. That we actually, what we saw, that's the truth for sure. I mean, I know I saw that. I mean, it was like it was a really obvious, I saw that thing happen. Well, I have a friend, someone who comes here often, actually, is one of my students for a long time, was not a policeman. And it's like he tells these stories of people who just like, you know, there'll be some scene they'll go to afterwards, and they'll get like six different witnesses to, you know, describe the person, and they'll get six different descriptions. Same person. And often those descriptions are based on cultural beliefs about who, what kind of people would do that. You know, long-haired hippie freak, I'm bound to have done that, you know, or whatever it was, you know. And so our perceptions, which we believe, are totally accurate, often lead us into this layer of delusion, because our perceptions are pretty much not accurate at all most of the time. There's some accuracy there. Yeah, the sky looked blue. Yeah, it looked blue. Okay. You know, but on a lot of levels, our perception is influenced by these cultural delusions and by our cultural belief that our perceptions are always accurate and correct. There's a great experiment that was done at some university. This is one of those psychology experiments where they were looking at the idea behind what's called directed perception, which is how we operate. We have perception. We have to direct that perception to a certain task, sometimes to do it carefully and accurately. If we don't, for instance, if say we're chopping vegetables and we're not directing our perception correctly, then we stand up cutting off our finger, right? So we have to be very sort of tune our perception into a specific task. But often this kind of perception shuts out everything else. So there's this famous experiment where they got a bunch of people, students at the university, they came and they sat in a room and they showed them a video. They were told beforehand that in this video, there's going to be a bunch of basketball players and they're going to be passing a basketball back and forth. And their job as observers of this video was to count exactly how many times that ball was passed. So this is a directed perception exercise, right? To really pay attention and count accurately how many times the ball was passed. And so the people watched the video. And then afterwards, a little questionnaire, and most of them got close or almost exactly right the number of times that the ball was passed. But then each of them had an interview, and the person doing the interview said, "Did you notice the guy in the ape costume walking across the basketball court?" And most people looked at the guy like he was crazy. Like, of course, like, what guy in an ape zone? I would have seen that. That would have been really obvious, right? But that's actually what happened. While these guys are passing the basketball, they have this guy in an ape suit walk in, he waves, and then he walks out of the frame. But he's in the frame for quite a while. And people who'd seen the video wouldn't believe it. In fact, when they showed them the video again, but now without getting into the count, and there was this guy in an ape suit walking through the middle of the basketball court, a lot of people swore, "This must be a different video. You're trying to trick me." They couldn't accept the fact that their perception was that wrong, that they couldn't actually have seen this guy in an ape suit walking through the video. But their attention was so focused on counting, their directed perception. This is a form of this cultural delusion where we think, "I know for sure that I got this right. I know I'm right and you're wrong. Or I'm right and they're wrong. I'm good and they're bad. I'm holy and they're children of the devil," which I've been called, by the way, by some people, which is interesting. I don't take it too seriously. But it's like, and sometimes these delusions also arise from a lack of information. Like, we just don't have enough information to make it a correct understanding of what's going on. But because we want to make a decision, we want to know something, we make a decision anyway. The classic story of all the blind men who all go and are told to touch an elephant. One guy touches the leg, one guy touches the trunk, and one guy touches the tail, one guy touches one of the tusks, and then they're all asked what an elephant's like. And the guy touched the trunk says, "Oh, it's like a snake," and the guy touched the leg says, "It's like a tree," and the tail is like a fly swatter. And they have all these different perceptions just because they don't have enough information. So often, if we can resist the temptation to want to have an answer, to accept the fact we just don't have enough information, that will prevent us from falling into one of these deluded forms of thinking. So it's something to, once again, where mindfulness, we can go, I just have to, live with the "I don't know," which is probably accurate most of the time anyway. More often than not, we really don't know. We just want to believe it's a certain way because of our cultural biases, because of our cultural delusions. It's got to be this way because it suits my 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 cultural background or my belief system or my political system or my religious system or whatever. So this is cultural delusion, harder to see, and often, as we can see out there in the world right now, leads to an enormous amount of suffering and an enormous amount of difficulty in the world. Just people acting out of some form of cultural delusion can cause great harm. And that includes us. We must remember this. It's not them, it's all of us. All of us have this propensity to act out of cultural spaces of cultural delusion. So it's something we have to be very aware of. And we can see in our sitting practice, when we're caught in one of those stories where the mind is spinning, it's often wise to go, sort of take a little bit of pause from the just noticing the moment by moment experience, because we got this story spinning, and go, is this based on some belief that is just a belief? It's not based on any solid personal experience. It's just how I was brought up. It's a very useful thing to do sometimes. And in our daily lives, if we're caught in some dispute, which we often end up being caught in some dispute with another person, or with a group of people, or with our parents, or with our siblings, or who knows, it's often very wise to sort of step back, pause, and just say to yourself, what am I not seeing? What am I not seeing right now? Or, as I said in the title, what the heck is happening? It's like, there's something going on here more than I've grasped. And it's very skillful to acknowledge that, both at the practice level in our mind and in our day-to-day level in interacting with other people. Okay, so that's form number two. So we got personal delusion, we have cultural delusion, and then the third, and probably the most difficult of all, is what I'll call human delusion. So cultural delusion depends on the person and where they grew up. And my cultural delusion and someone's cultural delusion in another country under a different political system, under a different religion, might be very different than mine. Personal delusions are personal. That's mine. I own that. But human delusion, here's the interesting thing. Human delusion is something that's universal. This is something that all human beings deal with, without exception. This is something, these delusions are human. It's sort of the fact of being human, these delusions arise. And so there's classically three delusions we keep getting caught by. We take what is impermanent to be permanent. We take what is unsatisfactory to be reliable or satisfactory. And we believe in a separate self when in reality there is no separate self. These are three that every human being has to deal with. And this is the bulk of the Buddha's teachings. Deal with how to overcome these three delusions, because they're the ones that get in the way of actually seeing things as they really are. We take something that's permanent because we look at something like this computer on my desk, right? I think, boy, it looks pretty permanent to me, right? But this computer is actually not solid at all. It's just, I have this concept in my mind that this is a computer and it's solid. I make this thing permanent. Truth is, at some point, this thing will dissolve into nothing. Now, because it's plastic and metal, it's probably going to take a while. Not like, say, a banana I had on my desk, which would, you know, last for a couple of weeks and then would be this blob of black goo. But it's like, it's not permanent. It's only this in our minds, we make things permanent because we want them to be. I don't want this computer to not be permanent because I depend on it to do all the stuff I do every day with it. So I make it permanent, often out of desire or out of fear that what if I didn't have this computer, what would I do? So it depends on your emotional makeup and how you look at things. And then this whole idea that we take things to be satisfactory. And by satisfactory, I mean they make us permanently happy. That's what, that's Buddhist, satisfactory is Buddhist code for something that always works to make us happy. And we decide these things are satisfactory because at some point they actually do make us happy. They give us pleasure. You know, a bowl of ice cream, a donut, I mean, who knows, a bag of Doritos. It's those things that we all, you know, or a new partner or a new house or a new car or a new job or a new whatever. They give us pleasure and we decide that this is something that's satisfactory. But inevitably, because things are always impermanent, things are always changing. Whatever you make into label it as satisfactory all the time never is. And this is how we create a lot of our own suffering and sometimes the suffering of others. But often a lot of our own suffering is out of thinking that somehow this is the thing that's going to always make me happy. And then it changes. Yeah. My old teacher, Swami Vishnu Devananda, used to tell, this was the big theme he harped on a lot to make us understand. And he had this story. And his story involved Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. Now, I don't know if some of you even probably don't even know who Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor are, but they were back in the day, this is in the 70s and 80s, they were like the perfect movie star couple, right? So, I mean, at one point when I used to teach this later on, I used to use Sean Penn and Madonna, but even that is probably like totally out of date at this point, right? But pick your, pick the favorite, you know, hip couple of the day. And we put their names in here and it'll be the same story. But anyhow, yeah, as somebody used to tell a story, he talked about, you know, Richard and Dick and Liz, as he called them. He was very on first name terms with them. We were walking down the street and they happened to walk by, you know, a famous jewelry store. And they're looking in the window and Liz sees this absolutely gorgeous necklace. I'm just like, and just like, oh, Dick, that would make me so happy to have that necklace. Dick says, yes, yes. And they walk on. A couple of nights later at dinner, they had dessert and he pulls out this box and he shoves it across the table and she opens it and there's the necklace. Oh, and she's like, oh, I'm so happy. You know, I love you so much, Dick. And she puts on the necklace and it's just like, she's at that moment, and that's the trickiness of these things. That necklace is totally satisfactory at that moment. But then by the end of the dinner, as they're going out in the street, she's starting to like, gee, you know, this is $1 million diamond necklace. You know, I better get some insurance in case someone, you know, robs me on the street. And, or maybe I should get like a fake, you know, pastiche version of it made and only wear the real one at special occasions and wear the imitation one the rest of the time. And so she, now she's already getting more things she wants and you know, that's just going on, right? But then the next day, she's still like in pretty much in bliss wearing this necklace around the house, right? A friend phones and tells her, you know, I hate to tell you this, Liz, but I saw Dick with so-and-so and, you know, he's been fooling around. And she gets really upset. And then she looks at this necklace and goes, ugh, that rat Dick gave me this necklace. And now it makes her totally unhappy. Now it's totally unsatisfactory. Nothing's changed. The necklace hasn't changed. It's still the same object. State of her mind changed. Just like that. So we keep, when we make things satisfactory, when we label them as satisfactory, it's always going to be making us happy, no matter what it is. It always entails suffering in the end because things are going to change. It's going to happen. And this is hard to take in because, you know, we have relationships that are really special to us, but think about it. I think I had a whole retreat where a lot of the retreat was thinking about this, actually, where I was really concentrated and I kept having these really powerful experiences where either I was dying and my wife was sitting beside the bed watching me die, or my wife was dying and I was sitting beside the bed. And we've been together almost 42 years. At that time, it was maybe 35 or something. But it was like, these were the most horrifying experiences. Because what I realized was, yeah, even this wonderful central thing in my life isn't permanent. It's going to change. And when it changes, there's going to be suffering on both sides. Person passing away is going to be suffering, and the person left behind is going to suffer even more probably. It's inevitable. Even this most precious thing in my life has built right into it impermanence, and if I make it permanent, I'm bound to suffer. It's just the nature of life. And we have to take this in and understand that that's true, as much as we don't want to. I see couples looking at each other and going, well, that's okay. So this is, and then finally, we have this sense of self. And essentially, the sense of self of me being separate from everything else arises because we want to be permanent. We want to be here forever. In our minds, we're permanent. I mean, we may at some intellectual level go, yeah, well, someday I'm going to die, right? But it's like, but not now. Right now, I'm permanent. I'm solid. I'm real, you know? And this is a whole teaching, a huge amount of the Buddha's teaching revolved around this idea of how we generate this sense of self. The primary method was something called the five aggregates of clinging, which I'm going to do a whole Dharma talk on in a couple of weeks. But it's like a way we actually create a sense that this self is real and permanent. And we create a lot of suffering in the world because we believe that and then act out of that place. I actually want to read something. This is from my go-to guy, right? Joseph Goldstein. Find the page here. This is from his book, Mindfulness, where he talks about I marked my book incorrectly. Oh dear. I have the wrong page number in my notes. So I have to now look through my book because my notes are impermanent. I'll skip that. We're not going to read Joseph Goldstein anymore. This talk is impermanent even. My plans are impermanent. And I'll go straight to my conclusion here. And the conclusion is basically that we have to learn to recognize when we are snared, when we're caught in the net of all three of these forms of delusion, personal delusion, cultural delusion, and these universal human delusions. It's difficult to do in daily life, because you're often rushing around headlong from one thing to the next, and we're not being particularly mindful. And this is where the practice is so valuable. You know, we see things arise in the mind, we sense that somehow there's suffering involved here, somehow I have some sense that something isn't right. You know, you get that feeling. You know, we all have those feelings. I sort of feel like I'm a little twitchy when I'm in this place mentally. I physically start to get a little twitchy. And so restlessness is one of the forms of delusion, actually, interestingly enough. And that's when we have to stop, tune into our bodies, and ask the question, what the heck is going on? What the heck is happening? This is when it's really skillful to pause, because we know when things aren't right. We often sense it at some almost visceral level. But we're so caught up in the onrushing life and all the stuff. Oh, I got to get here. I got this appointment and that. And I got to see this person and deal with this and blah, blah, blah. You know, some of you are probably much busier at work than I am these days. That if we don't stop, then and go, what form of delusion am I dealing with here? You know, that what the heck happening is really, which form of delusion am I caught in right now? Because usually there's some form of delusion going on when we have that feeling. And this is both in our lives, but also in our practice. You know, if you're caught in some long blah, blah, blah story in your mind, it's really skillful to sort of step back and go, what's going on? Like actually drop that question right into your mind space. And see what, and sometimes nothing's going to arise out of that. And sometimes it'll be like, you'll have one of those aha moments, a moment of insight into your personal delusive process at that moment. And it's like, It's so liberating when you catch yourself in the midst of some delusive state and you see it clearly. It's a very liberating moment. And it's also, the more often we do this, the more often it is going to be likely we don't get too far down the path of some delusive mind state or action or process before we catch it. It's a skill. This is a skill that comes with practice, but it's really something we have to consciously choose to go, oh, I better pause right here and take a look. Because that's what often tells us, oh, here I am, caught in delusion again. My old friend delusion. And there's, of course, the other. We don't beat ourselves up about this, which is often what happens. We catch ourselves in delusion and we go, oh, I'm so stupid. What's wrong with me? I never, blah, blah, blah. Now we're just beating ourselves up. We switch from delusion to aversion, aversion of self. Well, we've traded one poison for another. Very skillful. So it's like we can't beat ourselves up. We just have to go, ah, delusion. It's like this. This is what it's like. This is a delusive mind state. I can, it's very clear. This is what's going on. Okay. So that's tonight's talk. I want to have time for questions, comments, thoughts. And as always, I will say, don't feel at all obligated to say anything. I know often at the end of a Dharma talk, the last thing I want to do is talk. But if you do have questions or comments, I'm quite open to you sharing. Maybe you want to share some delusive experience you've had. Whatever suits you. So if you do, just wave or just turn on your mic and start talking. Oh, Penny, Jay, you actually went to the fore. Okay, so go ahead, Penny, you speak, please. I'm asking you to unmute.
I can tell a story of something that happened in March, soon after the lockdown started, end of March, April or so. I had anxiety about the COVID and I had not been sleeping for more than like 3 hours a night for a couple or three nights. And I was out taking a walk and went by, you know, every day I take the same little walk during lockdown. And I went close to neighbor's house. There's like a path and there's a tree there that has just the right height for me to grab onto and stretch out my spine, et cetera. And before I grabbed onto the limb, you know, I saw the neighbor's black BMW. I saw chrome and, you know, the black paint job, license plate, you know, it's like the car was right there. But, well, 50 feet away or 50 yards, whatever. But, so I did my thing with the tree, hanging from the tree. And then I walked towards her house. And it's like, the car was not there. I had totally constructed it in my mind. And neuroscience talks about this a lot, how, you know, we create our world in a sense. We put it together. You know, a baby is just in this space, still like in the womb or the cosmic soup. And, you know, it hasn't started labeling and naming things yet. And also, you know, I mean, every human does this, I think, too. You know, when we go to sleep at night, we have a dream, and that's a big delusion. But when we wake up, there's like this split second of putting ourselves together, putting our life together. It's like, you know, who, I'm this person, I have this role, but there's this split second where, yeah, but we go from one dream into another, basically.
Yeah. There's that classic line about, you know, is the dream world actually the real world and this life we're living actually a dream? You know, there's lots of ways we can look at this. But thank you. I love this. That's a great story because that's how our mind fills in the blanks, like, which is what you were doing with the BMW or on the tree. You know, the car was always there. So you just filled in the blank in your mind, which is, you know, that whole idea of perception being so inaccurate.
Yeah. I saw the chrome. I saw the shiny paint job. It was all there, the whole car.
Right.
But okay. It's just was just like a dream. Okay.
Right. Thank you, Penny. So Jackie also has her mic on here. So go ahead, Jackie.
Yeah, Penny, I had a very blur experience. So it's interesting that you bring that up. I was in high school and, you know, my friends and I went to Six Flags pretty regularly, Six Flags, the Village Gardens. And there was this one time when we're all standing around talking about some stuff that happened. And I jumped in and said, oh yeah, it was like this. And it was like a group of five people that had gone and they all looked at me at the same time. And they were like, you weren't there. I was like, what do you mean I wasn't there? And it's like, they had talked about it so much that I felt like I was there. And it took a minute to like really convince my brain that it's like, there are five people standing here all agreeing that I wasn't there. So I probably wasn't actually there. It felt really strange, for sure.
Yeah. Personal delusion. That's a good description of a personal delusion. Where we believe in something so much that it seems real, even though it's like just totally not actual fact at all. Memory is like that. Memory is very slippery. Memory leads us into a lot of delusion because our memory becomes very selective, especially as we get older. I know that for a fact. But yeah, memory. Okay. Anyone else have anything to say? Oh, Carolyn has her hand up here. Go ahead. I'm going to lower your hand and I'm going to ask you to unmute. Oh, you're unmuted. Go ahead, Carolyn.
I was going to share that early on when I first started meditating, it helped me get a better sense of, sense of self, but that's one of the human delusions that we struggle with. But I had a better sense of how I was feeling. I could sense suffering better. And so I became aware, gosh, probably only a few months into starting meditation, of like long-standing suffering that I had refused to acknowledge and kind of like shoved to one side and created a whole other story. And of course, you know, it had to deal with relationships in my life and family relationship, you know, the like deep-rooted stuff that. And I got to a point, I just couldn't live that way anymore. I had to acknowledge that suffering and I had to step out of that delusion because I was too aware of the pain that I was going through but previously had ignored. And I also have experienced, you know, I was just thinking cultural delusion. I lived in another country for 2.5 years. And before I moved over there, I thought, I'm going to be this effortless, glamorous expat who never moves back to the U.S. and I'm just going to be too cool for school. And instead, I spent the first 6 months crying more than I think I've ever cried in my life. And I also now look back and realize, now that I'm back here, there was a lot of cultural delusion on my part because I kept wanting things to be the way I was used to them being. You know, and I'm almost embarrassed to admit it, you know, but it was Australia and I love Australia. My husband's Australian. It's a fantastic country, a lot of similarities, but because there's so many similarities, it was like the differences were more pronounced. And because I was living there, it felt like a trip that went way too long, you know, like when's the return ticket? I had a lot of cultural delusion about this is the way things should be. This is how long things should be open. The hours of the stores should be 24/7 because that's how it is in America. And this and this and this and this and this. And it created a lot of suffering for me. And I now, you know, I wish I could have been more open-minded and tolerant and accepting of the differences, but instead I was very stuck in cultural delusion. So
yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, no more hands waving. Okay, so as always, I can't, I have to finish with the poem. This is from Dana Fald's book, Going and In. And it's called Staring at the Bones. Staring at the bones. Sooner or later, life in its variety and wisdom chews the meat from the bones of my illusions. It sucks the marrow from inside and throws the dry bone to bleach in a pile. Expectations are treated with equal disdain. Stripped of their finery, they are revealed as nothing more than future plans, easy ways to stay safe, roadmaps drawn by a blind cartographer trying to imagine distant destinations. This is the present moment's boot camp. Life's lack of rules will be obeyed, or I'll spend my time peeling potatoes in the past. I can choose to leave behind the skeletons of what I thought I knew and raise the flag of truth on the front porch. I can take a single step and wait for the next one to be revealed. I can only know where I am in this moment. Anything else is a desperate attempt to clothe the bones and set them walking. Pretty good advice. And she could be, this is what we have to do with all of our delusions. We have to chew the meat off them and throw the bones away. Just not accept them anymore. And it's uncomfortable and it's difficult because it's so like, well, this is the way it's always been. This is the way it should be. And all those things we keep telling ourselves. It's really skillful. Whenever you catch yourself going, well, this is the way it should be, or this is the way it always has been, or this is the correct way, or I'm right and they're wrong. Those are all moments when you should look and see what delusion is active. Because inevitably, pretty much all the time, there will be some delusion active at those points. Whether that's in your practice or that's in your life. Which of course is life is just another form of practice anyway, right? So that's it for tonight. Let's just dedicate the merit of the practice. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you all for sharing this time with me.